Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. For the lack of a better term, it is obvious the West has decided to continue and or reconfigure a new Cold War against Russia, but this time without so much ideology. Is this new Cold War more dangerous and destabilizing than the first? Crosstalking the new Cold War, I'm joined by my guest, Richard Sakwa in Canterbury. He is an emeritus professor at University of Kent, as well as author of The Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. And in Budapest, we cross to George Samueli. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, we're going to have a slight change of pace and format here. George, my partner at the Gaggle podcast, has agreed to co-host this program with the professor. And as such, George, you can tee it off. First question.
Richard, I really enjoyed your book, which is Who Lost the Peace? And I guess my first question would be, you know, the answer to the question you ask, who did lose the peace? Because at the end of the Cold War, there really should not have been any conflicts at all dividing Russia and the West. There were no ideological conflicts, there were no territorial conflicts, there were no economic conflicts. So what happened? How come we're in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the big mysteries of our time. How on earth did we manage to squander what was clearly a historic opportunity? And when we talk of peace, the sort of peace I have in mind is what Kennedy and others would talk about, a type of positive peace. That is, a peace focused on development, on cooperation, on allowing institutions working to work, above all those based on the United Nations. In other words, to use that vast human potential, the technological achievements of our time. Of course, in the face of ecological and other developmental issues, that was a moment for what I call a positive peace, instead of which, as you suggest, a negative peace became established and, of course, intensified to the point of a hot war today. So why? It's the 65,000 ruble question. I keep going on about that. And I don't want to give too long an answer, but I'm going to, you know, have to, because I'll give you my latest thinking on this, how we got to it. In short, I think I would argue that in the post-war years, since 1945, we've seen two arms of the West develop. On the one side, you have all those, you know, relatively positive elements focused on the West, but nevertheless benign and elements of development. This is the so-called liberal international order based on democracy, human rights, multilateralism. The United States after 1945 embedded its hegemony, its dominance in a multilateral institutions, including above all the United Nations. And this liberal international order after 1989 was then effectively globalized, and we had this, you know, globalization, which has delivered huge public goods. So that's the one side of the West, which is, it's got its own downsides, but it's got its upsides as well. However, a second West took shape after 1945. This is what I nowadays call the political West. This is the militaristic West. This is the one that was condemned by Eisenhower in his farewell speech, the military-industrial complex, what some people call the Trumanite state, focused on fighting communism, basically subverting democracies if they turn out to be hostile to the, or even questioning or critical of the United States, with all those coups in Guatemala, overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, and so on. This is that political West. So we have these two systems at work. And so in 1989, we all believed, I certainly did, that that political West could be pushed back, that security state, the militarism. And of course, it's one of its expressions was NATO. So that was the moment. Unfortunately, the exact opposite happened. That political West consolidated and extended, and of course, under the ideology of the end of history, claimed to be universal.
I'll pick up on that point here. I think one of the biggest problems, and I don't even think academia talks about it enough, certainly not in media, is that there are conflicting interpretations on how the Cold War came to an end. Now, on my side of the pond, the perception is that under Gorbachev, the Soviet Union opted out of the Cold War and suggested an alternative. But the West doesn't see that, never did see that, and called it a victory. And that's one of the reasons why we have this historical mismatch. And this mismatch is added with a lot of military force, a lot of rhetoric, and many cases where you can't control outcomes. So it's really, we could even add on the historical differences between the two sides.
Yes, and if there were voices in the United States who accepted that argument, of course. But on the whole, you just say the mainstream, the so-called blob, the establishment, the national security establishment, certainly never thought that, in other words, they claimed a victory that was totally spurious. When Gorbachev put an end to the Cold War, and above all, it was he, and of course, all those other people who developed the new political thinking in the Soviet Union, they believed that that international system established in 1945, the UN system, could finally come into its own. So Gorbachev never capitulated to the political West or the West in general, to Washington or anything like that. No, they said, let's let the system work so that we can all develop in peace together. But unfortunately, it ended up with the Cold War being continued by other means.
But if I could just follow up on that, there's still the mystery, which is, well, why did NATO then define itself in opposition to Russia? Why did it exclude Russia from its security framework? I mean, this couldn't have been just absent-mindedness. I mean, there existed the OSCE, there was the Charter of Paris in 1990. Everyone talked about the indivisibility of security. Everyone talked about the new era of cooperation. So what happened to that? Why did NATO then say, well, we will bring in all of these states, many of whom have a kind of a historic grievance against Russia, but we won't bring in Russia. And despite the fact that Russia wanted to be a part of some kind of a mutually beneficial security system, they continue to say no to Russia. And this is something President Putin has said repeatedly, that I said this, I suggested many times that Russia should be within NATO, and I was always rebuffed. Why did NATO define itself in opposition to Russia?
And it wasn't just Putin, it was Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s. They all said it. So, and of course, most of the Russian establishment, including many liberals, because quite clearly a defense system expanding with the exclusion of the main force against which it had been established in the first place was going to lead to, enormous difficulties and tensions. So it was quite clear that we had an intensifying security dilemma. Your question, why did they accept this logic? They, in a sense, to exclude Russia, there was, as this marvelous book by William Hill puts it, no place for Russia. Endless attempts in the early 1990s to establish a different type of security architecture, with some institutional innovation, bumping up the conference on security and cooperation in Europe, all failed because all of them would decenter Washington. So you could say, easily enough, the aim was to maintain Washington's dominance over its allies and globally. And of course, that was dressed up in a very benign way as the head of the liberal international order. But as I said, there's those two faces. And the negative face, of course, was the security side. And people were perhaps looking too much on the one side, the benign side, like a Dubin's jar vase, where you cannot see the two things at the same time, either a face or a vase or two faces. So exactly, it was a blindness. Of course, they did do attempts to mitigate it with the Permanent Joint Council of 1997, the NATO-Russia Council of 2002, but they were all palliatives. They were all just sticking plaster on a gaping wound.
Well, and, but Richard, I mean, it kind of goes back. I mean, in my introduction, you know, reconfiguring the Cold War, Russia had assumed it had come to an end. And during the first Cold War, I think it's easy to say, you know, it was about ideology. It's not about ideology anymore. So what is it about? Why is Russia the enemy?
Yeah. No, again, that's it's one of those great mysteries, because even worse than that, Russia wanted to join the West, but it wanted to join that liberal international West, not the political West. So it was this constant confusion between what face of the West would it try to enter. And this double face, this double bottom to the West, ultimately led to the repudiation of both. So, yep, it certainly wanted to join it.
And but Richard, if you're saying it's a double face, I'm sorry, I'm going to reinterpret it using my word. That sounds like schizophrenia to me.
Well, it's a double face, which you could say is all, you know, power systems, you know, couch themselves in terms of a civilizing mission, like 19th century British imperialism, while at the same time having a mailed fist in that velvet glove. And of course, Russia was then, and it makes all the opponents, of course, off balance, because you never quite know which face is going to be presenting itself, the benign face or the power-based face. Of course, today we know that the velvet glove has been thrown off and it's just the male fist, but which, of course, on both sides. And so the gloves are off and the battle is joined. But as you say, what's it all about? It's not ideology. Is it, then you could say, is it cultural, civilizational values? Is it simply the fact of, you know, defense of U.S. hegemony dominance? They cannot allow any alternative. And of course, this then applies to China and any other rising powers, implicitly Japan, if they do not accept U.S. dominance, U.S. hegemony.
Well, then, Richard, we're approaching the break here. So I guess it's kind of fair to say that we've gone back to 19th century great power politics. The Cold War was just some kind of interlude.
Yep. With one huge difference, that we have an international system based on the United Nations established in 1945 and its whole body of international law, which is becoming ever more ramified. For example, today the International Court of Justice is in session and dealing with the case launched by South Africa against Israel's...
I'm going to have to jump in here. I think the other difference is that there are nuclear weapons right now. That's a big difference,
indeed,
too. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the new Cold War. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the new Cold War. Okay, George, the baton is in your hand. Go ahead.
Well, one question that does arise, and it flows from what Peter was saying in the first part of the program, which is that, well, the Soviet Union did not regard that it had lost the Cold War. It just basically said that the Cold War was over. We're not interested in fighting it anymore. But for the West, it looked very different. They saw Russia as much weakened. And so therefore, you have to raise the question, particularly if you're a Russian, was it those fatal decisions that the Soviet Union took from the years 1989 to 1991, when they presumed they just simply dissolved the Warsaw Pact. They signed off on a united Germany within NATO that encouraged the West to think that we have a very weak adversary, and this is a historic opportunity to take advantage of this very weak adversary. And it really, the perception didn't change until many, many, many years later. But during that time, the West took one advantage of a weakened Russia after another. And it was just withdrawal from the ABM Treaty, bombing Yugoslavia, you know, you can just name them. But it was the weakness that Russia suddenly saw. So do you think that contributed to the new Cold War, if that's what it is?
Yes. So at the end of the Cold War, we could use a number of symbolic dates. We could talk about 1989 as the end of the Cold War with all of that positive peace agenda on the table. Then we can talk about another signal date, 1991, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and of course a continuous state, Russia emerging out of that, but a much weaker one, with total economic collapse and social disintegration, which of course nowadays there's a big debate about all of the 1990s. But yes, it was much weakened. And of course, then we also have a middle level, the year 1990, the year of Eastern Europe, which of course these former Soviet states and of course the former Soviet bloc states had their own views. And for them, the weakening of Russia, the Soviet Union, was the opportunity for them to regain their freedom, which of course was much to be welcome to allow these states. But unfortunately, they then embedded Cold War thinking into these free states, these now emancipated states, which of course then allied to those who see Russia as weak. Let's go for the kill, as it were, and never allow Russia to emerge as a threat, as a challenger, as a great power, as Peter suggested a bit earlier. But so that Russia, then Moscow, was then began to be presented once it began to assert itself that it would not be a legacy power like the United Kingdom, France, and of course the defeated powers of Germany and Japan. And that came as a bit of a shock to the to Washington, for sure.
Well, that's exactly the point, Richard. I mean, if we're working on the assumption, and I think George and I agree with you, is that there is a new Cold War thinking, and Russia is the target. So we shouldn't be surprised that Russia's reacting to being targeted in a new Cold War. Okay, so it is, and that is the preamble to the conflict that we have now in Ukraine. Right before, Russia said we have security demands, and they were ignored. Those security demands were a reaction to the new Cold War coming from the West.
Indeed, Russia found itself with enormous dilemmas, you could say, and of course it was, highly provoked. But of course, then the question becomes, does it have to rise to the provocation? Did it have, what was the scope, the room for maneuver? And that's where these huge debates take place today, that yes, we do see that the West mismanaged the peace, that we ended up in a cold peace for many, many years. But of course, then we have these other actors emerging, as I said, the year 1990 actors. Ukraine is one of them, if you like.
Yep.
Poland, the Baltic republics, all of these with bitter grievances, they could be managed. But unfortunately, within these countries, they were they were encouraged, we know that, by the U.S. Embassy in Kiev and so on, to prevent genuine, deep, enduring friendship between Moscow and Kiev. We all know the famous statement by Zbigniew Brzezinski that with Ukraine, Russia is a great power. In other words, a threat to U.S. dominance. Without it, it remains a second-rank power. So we now know with 35 years' experience that fundamental misunderstandings and indeed strategic perceptions which so differed and led on to this conflict today.
George.
So Richard, I mean, why then do you think that NATO and the United States continue to ignore the red lines? I mean, for years and years, Russia had been issuing warning after warning that it's not going to go on accepting this NATO expansion indefinitely. I mean, we remember what happened in 2008, and yet they repeatedly ignored them. And was this simply an underestimation of Russia's capability? Why would they think that Russia would just simply accept anything that was rammed down their throats? They just think that it's forever 1990 and that Russia simply is too weak to be able to defy us?
Yeah. Just slightly to elaborate what you're saying, NATO enlargement is obviously one of the key elements, but it was those larger bilateral security agreements, in particular vis-a-vis Ukraine, even with NATO enlargement it covers a multitude of sins, if you like, in different formats, yep, including now, for example, the UK-Ukrainian defense alignment. But you're absolutely right. It wasn't just Washington. It's the political West suffered from hubris. and a belief that they were on the right side of history, which meant that they were unable to manage the actual genuine history with which they were faced. In other words, paradoxically, after 1989-91, those sort of illusions which you could argue dominated in the Soviet Union, historicism, the belief that we know the direction of history and if we could push it along the path, escaped through the front door in the Soviet Union, but it came in through the back door into the political West. And of course, once you have a politics based on illusion, and two types of illusions, the neocon one, that the United States was really the world's dominant power, which it must ensure that no one else can challenge it. And of course, the liberal humanitarian illusion that now the world is ripe for democracy, and it's our job to push it along through regime change and all those so-called color revolutions. You know, we may all, obviously, I certainly do want to see the world more democratic, more free, and more economically developed. But that isn't the right way to go about it, in my view.
You know, Richard, I asked rhetorically in my introduction, is this new Cold War more dangerous than the first one? And, you know, one of the differences between the original Cold War and the way you've conceptualized it is that during the original Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union very rarely avoided direct confrontation. It seems to be different in the new Cold War with this proxy war in Ukraine. Is that one of the differences?
That's a huge difference. Cold War has come home to roost in its homeland, Europe, because in the first Cold War, it was basically fought in the so-called Third World. Today, paradoxically, the Third World, apart from Southwest Asia, Gaza, Palestine, and some other places, it's relatively stable. Whereas it's Europe, which is the dynamic front, which, of course, we're only at the beginning of it. We're seeing a huge NATO exercise coming up in the next few months. The warmongering and militarism all along. It would take one accident, one stray rocket. You know, who knows what's going to happen? Another thing about why this war is more dangerous. In the old one, it was relatively superficial. Communism versus capitalism. We knew what was what. This time, it's much more pernicious and much more pervasive. It's the cultural repression. For example, at universities in England, if you start questioning the sort of things which I've been doing, you are liable to be condemned. Can I just mention today, my good friend Slava Vyacheslav Morozov from the University of Tartu, I've just heard that he has been detained by the Estonian Secret Intelligence Service for allegedly, doing work to undermine Estonian security, assumedly working with the Russian intelligence apparatus. Absolute nonsense. I've known Slava for many years, one of the finest academics and most professional academics it has been my privilege to know. And today he is detained in jail in Estonia. So that is a sign of it.
Well, I guess part of the new Cold War is that, it's against bad think, okay? And it's come home, okay? I'm sorry, George, I'm out of turn. Go ahead.
Following on what you just said, which is very, very interesting, which is that the difference between the Cold War and what we have today, which is that, now the Third World is relatively stable and that the center of the conflict is Europe. And that does make things very, very dangerous because that really directly affects Russian security. So that's why I wonder, how do you see this war in Ukraine resolving itself? Because even, let's say, from Russia's point of view, the best case scenario, they drive out the Ukrainian forces from the Donbass, they take Kherson and Kharkov. There's still the 80% of Ukraine that's going to be left over. NATO is going to want to scoop it up. So how does this play out? How do we end this very dangerous confrontation?
Yes, and in all of our discussions so far, there's been the missing guest, as it were, and that is the European Union and the European powers acting as responsible leaders. In the old days, the Kohl and Thatcher and Mitterrand were all active at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Where today is their leadership? There's none except those which just are cheerleaders to the political West. So where Ukraine goes, It's a three-level conflict, one, as you suggest, within Ukraine itself, some sort of deal. We have to try to reestablish a European dimension, because ultimately Europe should take control of its own security. And of course, there's the global element with the United States involved. And of course, you could ask a fourth level, which is multilateral institutions, United Nations, hopefully, perhaps with a role for China, for Brazil and India, some of the responsible states in the so-called global south. So in other words, the resolution of the Ukrainian conflict cannot be in Ukraine itself. It has to be part of a much larger settlement, so perhaps an international conference. But of course, that needs goodwill, and I'm afraid trust and goodwill is even in less supply than it was in the First Cold War.
It's very interesting is that 2024 seems to resemble 1945 when Europe was apostate and it was outside powers that decided things. It's amazing. You know, history doesn't repeat, but it certainly echoes. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Canterbury and in Budapest. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.